Hi, I'm Dan.
And I'm JJ.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles.
Welcome back to the Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast where we look at impossible crime fiction.
This is episode 2 in a 3-part series where we are looking at the supposed top 15 locked room mystery novels of all time, curated by Ed Hoke in 1981.
In episode 1, we went through the last 5 novels on the list, books number 15 to 11. There will be a link below this if you want to check that out first. Today, we will be looking through novels number 10, 9, 8, 7 and 6, as well as having a bit of a discussion about the background, about how this list came to be, and looking at some of the people who were involved in its compilation.
Let's get straight into it. We are at number 10, and in at number 10 is the aptly named 10 Teacups from 1937 by Carter Dixon, also known by the title The Peacock Feather Murders. JJ, what's it all about?
The police receive a note informing them that there will be 10 teacups in a house at a particular time. This echoes a note that was received several years before, where, as well as 10 teacups found in the house at the appointed time, there was also a dead body. So they are inevitably incredibly curious to receive this note and to feel that there's going to be a repeat of these previous events. They send along a young policeman to shadow a man who is going to be in the house at the appointed time. The two of them ascend to the top floor of the house. The policeman is across the corridor from the young man who is in a room where the door is closed. Suddenly a gunshot rings out, and as the policeman runs into the room to find out what has happened, a second gunshot rings out. He immediately barges into the room, finds the man has been shot twice. The gun is lying on the floor in the room, gun smoke in the air, so the shots have obviously just been fired in the room, but there is no sign of anybody else who could have done the shooting and nowhere for them to hide.
And he certainly couldn't have shot himself.
No, not twice.
And not in the back.
No, that would have taken some doing.
Being so familiar with this book, why do you think it made it onto this list?
I think it's a great example of what Carr does very well. There's a couple of extremely baffling cases here. There's a second impossibility where a man is seen to walk into a house, only has 2 exits, they're all observed. The police effectively charge in after him after a short time, and not only is he not there, the people who were already in the house insist that he never entered the house in the first place, and they can't find his body. And there's a real air of fabulous mystery about all of it. There's a real air of how in the hell is this accomplished, which is something Carr really excelled at. So I can see it as a very classical extension of the locked room problem, in the same way that He Wouldn't Kill Patients, that we talked about last episode, contains a lot of elements of what Carr does incredibly well. I think similarly, this is, considering you've got, you know, 60 odd Carr books to choose from if you're talking about impossibilities, I think this is again another one that has very clean lines in terms of the problem it poses and some wonderfully simple ideas behind how it answers those questions.
Totally agree, and I feel like this is one of Carr's books that's super, super memorable. The whole setup of the close where the first murder takes place, the second impossibility is super creepy and wonderful. It's just one of those books that never leaves your mind at all. As you say, is kind of a really good classic Carr example.
I mean, it's not without its flaws, I do think.
Certainly, yeah.
I do think it is effectively 3 novellas that have been mixed up and put to make a novel. I don't think all of the plots intersect quite as cleanly as they should. There are some very good answers in there, but when you actually try to pull it all together into a fully cohesive narrative, I think it's very easy to separate into 3 strings rather than necessarily twist them around each other and make a sort of a proper strong rope of a plot that Carr would do at his best, as we will see in some of the later Carr books on the list. But it is incredibly memorable. The solution behind that disappearing body is one of the most memorable minor impossibility solutions I think that I will probably ever encounter in the genre.
Yeah, and if not one of the creepiest as well.
Mm.
To round up then, should it be there on the list, number 10, the 10th best impossible crime story of all time?
I think it's a little bit high for my tastes. I think if we go back to something like Invisible Green, which is number 15, I think Invisible Green is a more successful book. I think there are better cars than this. Again, I think the flaws in the overall structure, for me, hold it back. You do get to the end and you're like, wow, that's brilliant. And as soon as you start to unpick it, it unpicks quite easily and it clearly separates out into these three strands. I'm a little bit torn on this one. I can't say it definitely should, and I can't say it definitely shouldn't.
The issues are debatable issues as well. They're not flat out, you know, problems necessarily, but the joys are fantastic.
I would say if you want to pick pure car puzzles, I would put The Plague Court Murders, for instance, in ahead of this, which is not a book which is on this list that I really think should be.
Okay, yeah.
And I would definitely replace this with something like that.
Yeah, sure. So in conclusion, maybe yes, maybe no, but certainly a great example of what Carr can achieve, and the good parts of this are things that really shine out.
Okay, and so we move on from the aptly named 10th book on the list to the aptly named 9th book on the list, which is 9 Times 9 by Anthony Boucher from 1940. Dan, 9 Times 9 by Anthony Boucher.
9 Times 9 follows a man who has become famous for writing scathing takedowns of cults and exploitative religious organisations and their followers. One of the big cults that he's trying to take down, their leader is famous for wearing this mystical yellow robe. Two witnesses are in the garden of the writer's house and looking into his locked study through the windows, and they see this cult leader in his yellow robe. They suspect danger, so they run round to the entrance to the locked study. But when they get inside, the cult leader has vanished and the man has been killed. And one entrance is totally locked, one is watched, and the windows are inaccessible.
This, for me, was one of the first books that I read when I decided to actively pursue the reading of impossible crimes. It's a really nice, compact little puzzle, I think.
Yeah, conversely, this is my first time, having read this book, to read a Boucher novel in full length. I'd read some short stories and could see why he's lauded as such a good writer, but this was my first encounter with a full impossibility, and you're right, it's tight, again, limited locations, as we were talking about with some of Carr's best books earlier, and a really memorable cast of characters as well.
Do you think those factors, then, are they sufficient to justify its place on the list?
Again, it's one of those books that feels like it may have been voted on for its writing. The descriptions early on of this mysterious cult leader's church, when our main characters go and visit this church, is astounding and extremely terrifying. The way all these people worship this man and how the mystery is built up around him and therefore reinforcing the locked room in the study. Is really powerful and impactful writing. Of course, our kind of amateur detective in the background is Sister Ursula, who I think is a brilliant character and unfortunately doesn't come up enough, I think, in this book for the observations and the interesting ways about detection that she has, and as a nun and how that fits into the whole story in terms of religiosity and cults is really interesting.
So, given that we are looking specifically at these for their impossible crimes, what do you think of the impossible crime? Do you think that is good enough to be on this list?
I'm in two minds about it, really. The setup is lovely. What Boucher does with the cult leader throughout the rest of the story is very, very interesting. And there's another set of impossibilities that I won't spoil now, but that come up later related to the cult leader's presence, which are really nicely plotted and put in. The solution, I've struggled with. I think it's one of those solutions where there's a few elements to it, and some of it you're like, that's absolutely brilliant. Other parts you think, did that really need that? Is that totally acceptable, believable? And I'm still in two minds about it slightly.
Boucher had a good understanding of impossible crimes, because of course there is a section of this book where our detective uses Cars to Hollow Man as a model for trying to solve the murder as he faces it. And he's trying to, I think it's part of the game playing of GAD, trying to show that Carr suggests that that locked room lecture in chapter 17 of The Hollow Man provides all of the possible solutions. And this is Boucher sort of nudging him and saying, I think you'll find there's something you haven't thought of, John. Do you think on those grounds, the fact that he's obviously trying to push something a bit new, do you think that makes it a bit more acceptable in terms of the flaws that you see in it?
That's a really good question. It's obviously a kind of meta narrative, a meta Golden Age style novel in that sense. And I love the fact that our detective, his wife, is really into locked room mysteries, and she's the one who gets him to read The Hollow Man. He stays up all night reading it, and then he's like, but this doesn't help us in a real murder. This is all good for fictional murders, etc., etc. And there's this lovely kind of play on the meta-narratives, which in a way, if you're thinking about a list of top 15, the praise that it gives to Carr and to the locked room genre maybe give it a stronger foothold to be in this list. But again, if we're doing it for pure impossibility, I'm still in two minds about it. But he's a great writer, and it is a wonderful book. And for my first outing with Boucher, I really enjoyed it.
I can definitely help with another Boucher book that definitely doesn't need consideration for this list. The follow-up to this, which was the second and final Sister Ursula novel, was called Rocket to the Morgue, and also contains a locked room murder, or a locked room attack, which is probably one of the worst I have ever read.
Okay.
So this one possibly, again, I can see there are flaws with it, but Rocket to the Morgue, while it does some things very well, locked room murder is definitely not one of the things it does very well.
In at number 8 is The Chinese Orange Mystery from 1934 by Ellery Queen. Now we've had 10 teacups at 10, 9 times 9 at 9. We haven't got an 8 here, but this was the 8th Ellery Queen novel, and something's mysterious is starting to link up here. Maybe we're revealing something about this list that's deeper than we realise. So, JJ, The Chinese Orange Mystery, what's it all about?
Chinese Orange Mystery is set in and around a publisher's office and set of rooms which are on like the 22nd or the 23rd floor of a New York skyscraper. Essentially, a publishing company is run by two men, and one day a visitor arrives out of the blue wishing to speak to one of the two men who is not present at the time. So his partner asks him to wait in the waiting room, which adjoins the office. A couple of hours pass, various people come to visit the publisher in the meantime, and he suddenly remembers this visitor who is waiting in the waiting room next door, tries to go through the door. The door is locked, so he goes around the outside, around the corridor, in through the second door to the room, which is not locked, and finds that this man is not only dead, but also that everything in the room has been reversed. The bookcases have been turned around, the desk has been turned around, the carpets have been turned upside down, the sofas have been turned around, even the corpse's clothes, all the way down to his underwear, have been taken off and put on him backwards. Why done it?
To me, when I read about this early on in my excitement of getting into detective fiction and locked room mysteries, I mean, what a setup. You just cannot avoid how exciting that sounds, you know, this reversal of everything, and why has it happened? It's maddening, and you want to get to the book straight away.
Yeah, it's one of those really kind of big, obvious situations that the Queen's devised incredible. Well, like we said with The King is Dead, it's a really wonderful, very arresting situation to have in this kind of a novel, and particularly to have this name attached to it as well. There's a really good chance you kind of rub your hands and settle down for something really quite diabolically clever.
But is it? That's the question. And why do you think it's on this list? Because there is some debate among, I guess, readers and writers that this actually isn't an impossible crime novel at all. I'd be interested in your opinion on that, but what do you think? Why is it on this list?
There is absolutely no debate. This is not an impossible crime novel. It is not an impossible. There is even, as soon as the body is discovered, a witness says, this door is unlocked. Nobody has been watching this door. There is a stairwell immediately down the corridor from this door. Any one of the 8 million people in the city could have come in and committed this murder. It is not an impossible crime.
I'd forgotten that. There is quite a frank admission in that sentence. He says exactly those words or thereabouts, doesn't he? So then why is it on this list, and should it be here?
I mean, there is a locked door, as we say. The door between the publisher's office and the publisher's waiting room is locked. So there's that. But there is also an unlocked door and an unlocked skyscraper and a stairwell that any one of 8 million people could have come up. So, yes. I mean, it's not an impossible crime. It is nearly an impossible crime. There are aspects you can understand when you read it why it is considered an impossible crime, because sure. There's a very technical aspect to what has happened. But it's not actually impossible. It's not as if someone is seen entering the room and then they are not there, or it's not as if...
Watertight, is it? We don't get a description where, like we would in a classic locked room, where every aspect that could have happened is taken down one by one, so there's something else and we have to try and figure it out. Here, we're given the fact that, well, it could have happened this way, and, you know, that's then not really explored any further, yeah. I guess. But are there any merits to this book that could bring it onto this list, or just for the sake of reading it itself? What do you think about this book under its own merits?
On its own merits, it's actually quite entertaining. The problem is phrased in a very interesting way. Mm. You obviously have this closed cast of people, one of whom must be the murderer, because that's the kind of books that Ellery Queen wrote.
For sure.
Anybody who follows my blog will be aware of the fact that I've had tremendous struggles of late trying to get too excited about Ellery Queen's early period. And when I read this fairly recently in preparation for these recordings, there is definitely sort of a relaxation in the style of writing. They're not quite so frenetic, they're not quite so turgid, dare I say, in their procedure. The fact that the problem is, as we say, so much fun definitely helps.
Yeah.
So it's an incredibly entertaining way to pass a couple of hours. It's an incredibly entertaining example of this kind of GAD. But again, as we said with The King is Dead, I do feel very much as if this is on this list in acknowledgement of all of the huge amount of work that Dan A. Lee did under the nom de plume Ellery Queen in the genre. You know, I feel this is more here out of respect than it is out of merit.
And I'll say similar things to what we said about Ellery Queen's King is Dead as well. I think on the one hand, it would have made a great short story again. And I think the solution to why everything is reversed has some really good points to it. But as people who've read this are aware, or as you mentioned on your blog yourself, there's some very complicated elements that you end up reading 5 or 10 times over to try and work it out. But there's elements to it that are interesting. And again, in a short story, would have been great. The second thing I'll say, similar to The King is Dead, is that I think it's another example of the Queen's coming up with an interesting idea. It's a shame they didn't do more with it, I think.
Okay, before we go on to the last couple of books on the list, we thought we'd give you a little bit of a glimpse behind the curtain. Dan and I had originally planned to record all three of these episodes at once and then have a bit of time to edit and release them one per week. We only got the first one done in time. And since then, we've had really great response from people on our blogs and on the GAD Facebook group, where people have said, you didn't mention, for instance, the Swedish GAD expert Jan Broberg, which, no, we didn't. We're sorry about that. You didn't mention Howard Haycraft, who had a tremendous influence in writing what was effectively the first proper study of Golden Age detection, and as well as writing the what became the Haycraft Queen Cornerstone List, which is the list of what would be considered essential books to read comprehensively or to read well in the genre. And we thought we would use this episode to go a little bit into the background of how this list came about. Last year, I bought some books off of Marvin Latchman, who was one of the original voters on this list, and I emailed him in the run-up to this to ask if he would be willing and able to share his memories of being involved in the voting of how all this came about. And so Marv very kindly shared with us his experiences, and we thought we would just spend a few minutes just talking through how this came to be.
So you just mentioned this idea of connectivity. You know, we only met through our blogs. Now we're doing this podcast, which we're releasing back to our readers and followers. And it's fantastic. We're connecting with people all over the world. But of course, at the time this list was compiled, they didn't have that type of connection. And Marv was kind enough to talk to us a little bit about what that looked like at the time. And He says here that in 1969, he started what he called a mystery readers party at his apartment in the Bronx. And he said that he would time these parties to coincide with the annual Edgar Awards banquet each spring. And some fans were beginning to attend the Edgar Award, and he invited those fans that he'd met, and they invited authors, and this became a bigger group. And then one person called Al Hubin brought along Ed Hoke, and that's how this kind of group started talking with each other, which he says naturally evolved the group that created this 1981 list. They were meeting at these parties in the Bronx. I just think that's such a kind of romantic vision of this culture at the time.
It's really cool. I mean, if you think about how you and I know people whose opinions on GAD we trust, if you think of someone like Noah Stewart, we wouldn't know anything about Noah. He's in Canada. We wouldn't have any idea at all about Noah were it not for his blog. Like, and it's crazy to think of all of the opinions that we've exchanged with all the people around the world. I think it must have been really quite phenomenal to be able to meet up with people who shared those enthusiasms and who had that same level of knowledge. The awareness spreads very easily now, and I think there's just that really cool idea. Yeah, that maybe romantic is the right word. There is that really romantic idea of all these people who have this tremendous enthusiasm, having the opportunity to meet with and to then get to know and set up this network of people, this other tremendous enthusiasm, and see what has come out of that over the years. And obviously one of the things that came out of that is this list, which is still being hotly debated, probably long after they imagined it would be.
Yeah, I wondered if they would imagine it being shared around the world now, available online, you know, available to debate. And who would have thought that in the future that it'd be worldwide, you know, that people would know about this list everywhere. And that's fascinating.
We had there was a bit of a discussion as well about precisely what the intent behind this list was, and the extent to which, when you have a lot of people contributing what they felt to be the best impossible crimes, whether we feel that the idea behind this list is it is best impossible crimes, whether it is the best cross-section of impossible crimes. Marv actually shared with us the books he could remember voting for, which I thought was really interesting. A handful of John Dixon Carr books, Agatha Christie's, and then there were none, which I always think is quite an interesting one to debate.
Yes, for sure.
How impossible that is.
Absolutely.
It's one of those, I call it a retrospective impossibility.
Because
you get to the end. Ellery Queen's The Tragedy of X. I've not read, so I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on the impossible elements of that. And I mean, as Marv says, I doubt I would have now voted for any different books, because as Hoke pointed out in his introduction, there haven't been that many great locked room novels lately, nor have there been many impossible short stories. And so it's really interesting to think that this may well have been partly a reflection of the peak of the genre has passed, and so it's almost an attempt to capture from people who have a really well-rounded understanding of it, try to capture what made the genre special, what made this particular type of novel special, on the understanding that perhaps it was in decline, and so therefore something about it should be remembered.
And what's fascinating thinking about it in those terms is that this was almost 40 years ago, but the books they're putting in the list, some of them are 40 years before that as well. So we're getting this, it's always looking back, this whole history, and seeing a whole context together. It's fascinating. I also had a quick chat with Douglas G. Green, who's co-owner of Crippen and Landrieu, and who was also part of the original list. And I posed to him this question that kept coming up, as you were saying, on the Facebook group, on the blogs. What was it? Was it really about the best impossible parts of the books? Was it the best books containing an impossibility? Was it the most interesting kind of cross-section, like you said? And from Douglas's memory of what he could remember from nearly 40 years ago, he said it simply was, we were asked for our favourites to put into a list. And it's interesting because in a way we'll sort of never know what the motives were behind each of these fans, writers, obsessives of this genre for picking what they did. And it would be great to be able to find that out, but I guess in the end we're left with a list that is a cross-section of some of the most knowledgeable both writers and historians of the genre giving us what they think. And of course some of their books were dropped off. It's a point system, isn't it? So we get a cross-section of that cross-section as well, and we get this mixed bag, therefore. It's really interesting, I think. Maybe that's part of its joy, maybe that's part of its problems as well.
So yeah, so we are incredibly grateful to Marv and to Douglas for sharing what they can. And we're really grateful as well to those of you who have engaged with this online and who have kept this conversation around this going. So please do just keep pitching in. We are doing this partly to provoke and promote conversation among people, because this is stuff that hopefully we are enthusiastic about in the same way that these guys were enthusiastic about nearly 40 years ago.
Shall we move on to the next one?
I think we probably should. A 10 at number 10, a 9 at number 9, the 8th book at number 8, and at number 7, a book with 7 consonants in its title. Death from a Top Hat by Clayton Rawson from 1938. Dan, take us through Death from a Top Hat.
Death from a Top Hat, or sometimes subtitled as The Magician's Murder, is all about a man called Sabbat who is found dead in his locked apartment. Many people are summoned for a meeting at the apartment and they find the door locked. When they break it down, they find him sprawled out on the floor. He's been strangled, but not only has he been strangled, he's surrounded by a black circle lying in the middle of a pentagram with candles at his hands and feet. It's a classic kind of satanic murder setup. What looks like has happened is he has invoked the spirit of a demon who has then strangled him, because all the doors and windows are locked from the inside and one of the keyholes is stuffed with material. There's no way that anyone could have got in and out. There are then another two impossibilities after that. One disappearance from a taxi cab, and then another murder happening in very similar circumstances to the first. I think essentially it's called Death from a Top Hat because we have death being pulled out of the hat. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We mentioned last episode, He Wouldn't Kill Patients was the result of a challenge between Carr and Rawson to write a particular kind of story. So Carr and Rawson obviously knew each other outside of their writing. This one really struck me when I read it. It has that very classic Carrian setup of the first half exclusively in a single location, mm-hmm. where things just seem to be getting more and more and more baffling. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that and kind of how that contributes or possibly detracts from the mystery.
It's interesting because it builds up as they find more and more about what's going on in the room. I mean, they find something under the body, for example. They explore every single part. And actually, when they burst into the room in the first place, the darkness plus the scene of these candles and then exploring the rest of the flat is all very creepy. And as more and more people arrive or get involved, and then eventually, of course, the great Merlini, the detective magician, is called in. There's a really nice sense of atmosphere is built, and then kind of bang, 100 miles an hour, we're off to two other crimes and we're flying around London. And that's quite interesting. It does have that totally Carrian feel to it. At the same time, there's a lot of this novel that drags and is disappointing. So what gives you a great beginning by the end doesn't tie together in a way that you would have loved to have seen from reading the start. Yeah.
I think a couple of the answers are a little unrealistic in one case and certainly a bit simplistic in another. Mm-hmm. And sometimes simplicity in an impossible crime is part of what makes it beautiful.
For sure.
But I think I would agree that there is an element here that you get to the solution, and again, it's a little bit like 10 teacups, where you see how it all hangs together and you start to question quite how necessary it was for things to be done in that way.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
How it necessarily just works, again, as strands rather than a rope that is constructed in a rigorous manner.
Here, Rawson is having to stretch the ideas, which is ironic, seeing as it's full of so many things happening. But as you say, the solutions and the mechanics of some of the murders are a little thin on the ground towards the end, and it ends up being one of these books that you're not like, okay, I can deal with that, but it's complicated. It's more like, that's actually frustrating and annoying that that was what happened, when things seemingly could have gone a lot better.
So how do you think it ended up on the list then?
I think maybe it's similar with Carr, although Rawson didn't write as many books. It seems that Rawson was committed to the impossible crime genre. I mean, at least everything that the kind of the big hitter names of his novels and short stories all have magical or impossible elements. And there's a really nice little dedication from Carr at the beginning of A Graveyard to Let, where he says, this is dedicated to Clayton Rawson, for those two great arts, friendship and magic. And it's quite sweet. And obviously they were concerned with this genre and how, and the idea of misdirection and how magic elements could be brought into a novel. So maybe it's a similar thing. It's a mark of respect to what he was doing. When you think of Impossible Crimes, maybe people were drawn to his novels because he tried to write quite a few of them himself and bring in a unique idea of them.
Do you think it's too high, too low, out of place entirely?
It's another difficult one because there's obviously elements of it that are great. The whole setup is brilliant and you want to love it. But I think if we're again, as we keep saying, coming at this from pure impossible angle, I don't think they hold up in the end. And there's some tricky elements to the solution, frustrating elements to the solutions that I think, and not every locked room mystery needs the perfect, the most clean, the most simple solution. It can be mechanical, it can be audacious, as I said in episode one, but it's got to work in its context. It's got to work in its world. And I don't think it necessarily does that.
I think this for me is a bit like the 10 teacups in that the first time I read it, I really enjoyed it. And if you go back, I believe I gave this a 4-star review when I reviewed it, however long ago that was. But I think my tastes have moved on and necessarily this book has not changed. And so I'm with you to a certain extent.
Have you read any other Rawson novels?
Yes, I've read No Coffin for the Corpse.
Is that better, do you think?
It's terrible.
I was going to say, is there another novel that could replace this?
No,
you know?
Not by Rawson. Apparently this is his best one.
Okay. In at number 6 is The Big Bow Mystery by Israel Zangwill. I'm trying to find a 6. JJ, what's it all about?
The Big Bow Mystery is just pure, simplistic, classic framing. As a landlady who is unable to wake her lodger one morning, door is locked, can't get in, worried for his safety, goes and gets a neighbour. Together, they break down the door and find the lodger has had his throat slit. The windows are closed and locked on the inside. The door was locked on the inside. How could it have happened? How could the killer have got out?
And this is 1892. This is early, early stuff. I mean, we've got 1977, 1967 on this list. We're going back here, 1892. Is this the first kind of thing of its kind? I mean, we're talking pretty early days for the locked room mystery here.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I do think this is the point where the locked room mystery really properly began. A lot of people would cite Gaston Leroux's The Mystery of the Yellow Room, which I think is 1906, 1907. But I think this brings something to the locked room genre that was not there before and is legitimately trying to expand the concept of a seemingly impossible murder. It's a very, very, very canny piece of plotting. And I would say this is where it really begins as a subgenre to be taken seriously.
I love this book. When I first read it, I had it as a little Kindle book on my phone and I was remembering reading it in the night, whipping through it and just loving every moment of it. Another real favourite part to me is that the person, the neighbour who is called is of course a retired police detective, and then a younger police detective is put on the scene and they become this great rivalry through the book where they both are offering solutions and you either want one to win or the other, and a great example of detective plotting so early on as well.
I mean, the detective plot is actually a very minor aspect. This was published in weekly installments.
Okay, yeah.
And if you just want the setup and the detection and solution, you can effectively take the first one for the setup and the last two, because there is a false solution, which is a wonderful innovation at the time. Mm. Virtually everything that happens in between is just sociological comedy gold.
Absolutely.
And it is, I cannot tell you how funny this story is. I mean, you don't need any of it. It is such a fun piece of writing. Yeah, I absolutely adore it, just because of how fast it moves and how many aspects it sort of throws in very effortlessly of what is now an entirely lost time in society.
So why is it on this list then, and should it be there? We're talking the 6th best impossible mystery of all time.
The solution, the false solution, the real solution, they're fairly basic stuff. So is it the best in regards of what it does with the impossibility? No, it couldn't be. That would be a real shame if it was. I think it's there because it's so influential, because of what it encouraged other people to then go on and do. I love that it has that thing that Anthony Barclay talked about in the Poison Chocolates case in 1929, where just because you have a clue, it doesn't mean it only points in one direction, which is obviously what enables the false solution and then became one of the tenets on which most GAD was built. I think it does that brilliantly, and I think it encouraged a lot of people to think about how they wrote, to be fair, not just impossible crime mysteries. If you look at what was being written around this time, we've got Sherlock Holmes, you've got Gerald Verner's Latimer Tribe stories, you've got the Sexton Blake stories, a lot of the pretenders who sort of sprung up around Holmes and in the wake of Dupin. The stories are very inventive, but the solutions are often quite banal, and it is often characters in this story are Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes, the young woman who's being terrorized, and her suspicious uncle.
Dun, dun, dun.
And you feel as if there is not quite the narrative complexity. Zangwill starts to introduce by having a false solution, by having clues pointing in a couple of different directions, by allowing more than one interpretation of what is going on. I think the influence of this is incredible, and I think it's very well written. Should this be on the list? I just don't know. I just do not know, because it's incredibly, it is a book that you should read if you have an interest in classic detective fiction.
Yeah.
It encouraged so many of the fundamental aspects of classic detection, but it is not one of the best 15 locked room mysteries ever written.
I mean, if we were talking locked room mysteries of the 1800s, then maybe. But again, as we were talking about earlier, the whole motivation of putting these things together is difficult to grab onto, and how the whole lists came to be. But I think I'm happy it's there. And if in a way more people read it, then that's brilliant.
So that is books 10 to 6 of the 15 best impossible crime novels of all time. Be sure to join us next week when we will be getting into the top 5.
Thanks for those who've joined us in discussion over at our blog so far, and please do so again. We love to hear whether you think these novels should be in this list or not. I blog at The Reader Is Warned, and JJ blogs at The Invisible Event, both on WordPress. So we'll see you there.
Bye-bye.